are the pirates who don't do anything. We just stay home and lie around. And if you ask us to do anything, we'll just tell you we don't do anything. We're the pirates who don't do anything. We just stay home and lie around. And if you ask us to do anything, we'll just tell you we don't do anything.
You are listening to the Pirate Monk Podcast from SamsonSociety.org, and with me today I have, of course, as always, my faithful cohort, Nathan Larkin. And what's been going on in your world, Nate? What's up?
Well, David Mullen, my friend. It's good to be back. It's good to be back on the podcast. We actually...
We took a week. I got about 100 emails saying, where's the third episode? And I was like, Nate went to Tampa and I can do it by myself.
It was a rough week. I missed the podcast. I missed my regular Samson meeting on Monday night. But I was with my wife. We had a great time down at Tampa.
Well, just so if anybody asks you, the official version was that we took a week off for Thanksgiving.
Okay.
Even though it was past Thanksgiving.
That's a good explanation.
And I thought that was pretty good. So normally here we talk about what we're reading lately, but we both are like, well, I'm not reading a whole lot that's real pertinent to the issue. So, but I did hear that you had some advice for those of us who buy a lot of books on the new readers, the Sony Reader versus the Amazon Kindle,
yeah. Well, yeah, I've been introduced to the new reading media, obtained through the good graces of a friend and a healthy swap. I got a Sony e-reader.
There you go.
Which is just good enough to make me know I want to buy a Kindle.
Yeah, the Sony is not that good?
It's kind of a pain in the neck. It's not wireless, and you've got to download the stuff to your laptop first and then move it over. And it doesn't keep notes the way the Kindle does. But I love the fact that I don't have to take an armload of books. I read a lot on the road, but I read junk on the road.
Right.
That's how I reward myself. It used to be that when I went out of town, I watched porn and hired hookers. Now I read detective novels is what I do.
Well, there you go. I mean, detective novels or hookers. I mean, which one is really? I mean, it's all even. It's in the wash there.
So I read a couple great detective novels on the trip.
Oh, did you?
Yeah. And I love
Any endorsements there?
Well, I don't know.
You don't want to do that, huh?
I read the new Elmore Leonard, Road Dogs, and let me see. I read an old, the great thing is that at my age, I can read the same book three or four times a year and not remember.
That's a great book.
Yeah.
And then read it a couple times.
Child. I read an old Lee Child.
Any hookers in that book?
No hookers in that book, no.
A Kindle? You know what I love is I do a lot of research too, and just you're able to take email these papers to yourself at the Kindle that have they give you an address and you approve each address individually that sends you things, and I read a lot of scripts and manuscripts from people, and so I get those sit directly to my Kindle and they format right away and they read just like a book. And
oh, that's gonna be sweet.
It's very nice.
I get a lot of manuscripts given to me, and it's such a pain to read them off the
right and to carry them around because they're always bound, at Kinko's. And so it's like this enormous thing, like big loop bindings in it, and you're carrying it around this all the time. And so like when you're on the road, like this year, I went to Africa, to Rwanda during the Reconciliation Conference down there, and it was so easy just to I had 10 books that I was reading for this research paper I was doing, and all I had was this little Amazon Kindle, and I threw it in my computer bag and it was all good. So I highly recommend that, and it's
Our listeners are fascinated
by
this.
I'm sure they are, and you can get you can't get porn on it as far as I know, so I think it's fairly safe, and so there you have it, and there you are. Welcome back to the Pirate Monk podcast from SamsonSociety.org. You know, every week we do sort of a spotlight on a different Samson group, or we're trying to do that. And as you hear these podcasts, if you'd like for your group to be spotlighted, please give us an email at letters@SamsonSociety.org. Also, we'd love to hear your stories, because stories are what drive all of this. Our stories, your stories, our guest today's story. These are, you know, that's how we connect with each other. We largely communicate and fellowship through our stories, and knowing each other's history helps a lot. So every week we're going to be trying to spotlight a group, and because we have Andy Gullihorn with us today, he attends a group in Nashville, and we wanted, do y'all have an official name, or is it just, this is our Samson group?
I don't know that we have an official name, the Nashville Church of the Redeemer group.
There you go, Church of the Redeemer, and that's where you meet?
Yes.
And it's a, you say it's a...
Church of the Redeemer is an Anglican church, and maybe about half the guys there go to that church. I went to the Franklin group here at Christ Community for a while, but Monday nights were always bad for me, and it was quite a trek from where I lived. And so, kind of selfishly, I talked to some other guys from church, and we went to the... brought him down to the Franklin group and said, do you think we could start something like this at my church, because it's only half a mile from my house? So
that's kind of nice.
Yeah. And we do on Tuesday nights. And so we've been meeting, I think, I don't know, what year is it? Maybe 2 years.
Yeah, you're
2.5 years.
Maybe three.
Wow.
Yeah.
Something like that.
That's impressive.
But yeah, it was a really weird thing for me, because when I first started, I was like, you know, it was three or four of us starting it, and I didn't want to feel responsible for it. Mm. But, you know, I invited a bunch of my friends, and the first meeting was a bunch of my friends, and it was incredibly awkward, because most of them weren't used to the format of Samson meetings. So, like, I was telling them they had to say my name every time, you know, or say their name before they talked, and they were like, what is this thing you're making us do? And, you know, it took a little while, and then people started to see how the liturgy of the meeting was really beneficial.
Right.
And not all those friends kept coming. So in different, the makeup of the guys is just totally different. The age range is, you know, all across the board. Mm-hmm. And
how many people come now?
I think normally between 10 and 12 guys. But, I mean, like, if you count all the guys who walk in through the door and come every other week or once a month, right. I mean, it's, I don't know, 30, 40 guys.
Oh, that's really?
Beautiful.
Yeah. So
I think that's perfect. Yeah.
Yeah.
And you guys just did your first retreat.
We did this summer, end of the summer, I think. We just decided, you know, we've been hanging out in the meetings, going to the meeting after the meeting, and what we were.
You guys go to a Mexican joint.
Mexican restaurant. Yeah.
Okay.
We kind of thought what was missing was just, it would be beneficial to all of us if we just knew each other's story a little bit more. Just background, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so we got a place up in Ashland City and went just to hang out. No program other than splitting up time for everyone to just take 40 minutes and just give a basic background. Knowing that we're going to do more in the future and get a little bit more in depth. But just that, really just the intentional part of going on a retreat together. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing with the Samson meeting. I remember one friend saying, well, I don't know if I'm going to come back. I don't always get a lot out of it. And I was like, well, that's not the point to me. The point is showing up and living life together on a consistent basis so people get to know you.
Mm-hmm.
And even just making a decision to go and be a part of these guys' lives.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the retreat was awesome, and what was shared there was awesome, but I think the most important part is that we all just decided to clear off a day off, you know, take a weekend day and a night to go spend time together. And when you know that guys are willing to do that, you look at each other differently when you see each other in the coffee shop or at church. It's just totally different. So it really kind of upped the dynamic of the Samson meeting. Man, it's just been a lot of fun.
Well, wow. You always talk about that, Nate, about how the turning point for most groups is that first retreat that they have.
Yeah, it was true for us in the Franklin group. You know, we started with 12 guys. By the end of the first year, regular attendance had risen to 7. Mm-hmm. And that's when we decided to have a retreat. We invited everybody who'd been through the door that first year. We wound up with, I think, 18 guys. How many did you have at your
retreat? I think that's pretty close, between 15 and 18. I don't remember the exact number.
I think we had 18 guys at that first retreat. We did 2 nights, which was just tremendous. And we focused for the retreat on the Silas relationship. We really talked about that because it wasn't functioning very well up until that point. Mm. But that retreat is what really turned it around. So my advice to young Samson groups, if you've been going for more than 6 months and you haven't had a retreat, it's time to get one on the calendar.
Right. And can they find your group at SamsonSociety.org?
Yes.
Yeah.
And on there it would just be called the...
I think just Nashville Samson Group.
Nashville Samson Group. Okay.
Yeah, they search Nashville. It's probably... I don't know if there are any other ones like actually in proper Nashville at this point.
No, I think you guys stole that one. You got the name. You got the rights forever, perpetually.
Yeah.
Check out the Nashville group at SamsonSociety.org.
Over the sea, you'd be a career as a buccaneer. It's the life of a pirate for me. Oh, the life of a pirate for me.
Do you have any letters from readers there on your Kindle, David?
I do. Well, not on my Kindle, but this one came to me via computer.
All right.
From some nut job. I think it was you.
Oh, okay.
You forwarded me this one just so in case
don't
remember.
But the letter's from a nice person.
And, who shall remain anonymous, right?
This is true, yes.
True, yeah, okay. This is a letter from a listener who is a wife, and she says, "Hi, it was great hearing Hallie on your last podcast. I can very much relate to her story. My husband has been attending the Franklin Group for a few months, and now I'm very proud of him. However, I feel that I need some sort of support on the female side of things. I'm very devoted to my husband and want to find trust in him again. Are there any support groups for wives in the Nashville area that you could recommend? Even if it's not an official support group, it would be great to connect with a few women in my area. Thanks so much." And I think you should tell them about that resource that we were talking about the other day.
Yeah. Well, I did forward that letter on to Hallie, and I'm quite confident that Hallie hooked up that leader with the group that she's a part of locally. It's always heartbreaking for me, though, to get that question, because I get it almost anywhere I go. Usually, typically, the first question I get from an audience has to do with my wife or their wife or a marriage. And it's a sad truth that there's more support for addicts these days. Not that there's a ton of that, but there's more support for addicts than there is typically for their wives. That's why I was thrilled this week when I got another email from another listener who directed me to a website called pornaddicthubby.com.
Okay.
I checked them out with our good friends at Covenant Eyes, and they're legit and doing great work. An online community with some great resources for wives. PornAddictHubby.com.
Yeah, and just fair warning, that will show up in your reports because the word porn is in the URL.
Oh, yeah.
And just so you know, and you can like let whoever's monitoring your history or whoever's sharing in that walk with you so they'll know that. Okay? So
so it surprised you, David, when you got my report from Covenant Eyes.
Right.
And it said I'd been to...
That's right. What's this all about, sir?
Yeah, he calls me up.
Well, I mean, that's what you're supposed to do.
You are. Yeah.
You know, so, I mean, I don't know what it is. It could be some...
Right.
Hubby porn or something, I don't know.
Yeah.
Whatever, you know. So I called to find out, and I found out. And so that's a really good resource, I think, too. And now on there, do they have links and stuff like that?
There's links for support. There's some diagnostic stuff. There's one piece there that a listener sent me that I thought stated very, very well the dilemma of the wife of a guy who's a porn addict. And just, we've said it before, let me say it again, not everybody who goes to Samson is a porn addict. I've been to meetings where most of the guys are food addicts. Had a great meeting. Mm-hmm. Then we had a meal, which was dynamite. But
and you ate a big burger, didn't you?
But I think this is great for guys to hear, to maybe understand a little bit better their wife's reaction to early recovery. Mm-hmm. It might be good for wives to hear this, too. This is called the Porn Healing Paradox, and it comes from the website at pornaddicthubby.com. Okay. Subtitle is, he recognizes his problem with porn and is getting better, so why do I feel worse? Mm-hmm. All right, here's his situation. He feels a new level of honesty and truthfulness. He has a new level of appreciation for the marriage bond. He finally has the accountability he was looking for. And he loves her more than he ever has before.
Yeah.
Now she feels the level of his disloyalty and deceit more intensely. Mm. Is saddened to realize how little the marriage has meant to him. Senses the shame and secrecy of being married to an addict, and has never felt less loved, valued, or secure. Mm-hmm. Bottom line, he wants congratulations for something that makes you want to throw up. This goes on to say, the emotions described above are true and valid for both the man and the woman, yet they're polar opposite. Why does this happen? He's been holding these feelings for a long time, and he's very familiar with them. It's a welcome relief for him to disclose his secrets and come clean. Sharing his burden with you means now you get to grieve over the loss of the relationship as you knew it to be. You get to feel some level of the shame he felt. You also have a finely tuned sense of distrust toward all of his actions. Welcome to the temporary insanity that healing from a porn addiction brings to a couple.
And really, you could insert almost anything there, couldn't you?
Right.
A drug addict, an alcoholic, a food addict.
Exactly.
Any of those things.
Be aware of the porn healing paradox as both of you move forward. Share this with him so he understands and appreciates your viewpoint as both of you work on becoming whole again. He needs to continue to earn your trust, and you need to continue to work on healing yourself and becoming open to trust again.
Mm. I think that's why it's so important to have that band of brothers that you're moving forward with, because it really does feel like that. Like, you know, you disclose whatever it is you're struggling with to your spouse, and you feel completely relieved. You know, finally I'm not carrying this secret anymore. And she feels like she's been hit by an atom bomb, and that's what we were talking about with Hallie last week. And it's like, how do we move forward? You know, how we move forward. And I think the only way to move forward is to move forward just one step at a time.
Yeah. You know? And to do it in community.
Yeah. Yeah, there's just a lot of stuff, I think, like, when you tell the truth to your wife, like, there's all these little incidentals that happen here and there, you know, that they just, I don't think, are real helpful, you know, in terms of, like, you know, I saw somebody today and that sort of thing, but I can tell you that, and you can, like, give me the correct, you know, reaction and the sort of thing, but for her, it's just like taking everything. You don't just like take one step back when you do things like that. It seems like they take you all the way back to zero or beyond, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
So it's real important to have that, I think, group of men who will bust your chops over certain things. And it's real important to have a place where you can really be truthful all the time.
Yeah.
And I think that's the thing that I see with guys that I work with. It's just that it takes a long time for them just to think it's okay, even like they've disclosed everything and then they just don't want to tell you any more. Then it's like, I know now I'm getting better, you know, now I'm on the road to recovery, and they don't realize that it is a process and that it's a becoming.
Yes.
And without that group of people around you and just witnessing what it looks like and going, you know, I really should be sharing, like, all the little foibles, all the little things, everything that all that whole world that's in between my ears that I won't live out in front of people, just get it out of me and in front of people.
Yeah.
So that we can literally deal with every little thing, make every thought captive to Christ, you know, and to me, Jesus is the hands and the feet of those people that are around me.
Yeah. So.
So today we have a friend with us who is a member of a group down in Nashville, and Andy Gullihorn is his name. He's a friend, a good friend of yours, Nate.
Mm-hmm.
And I met him for the first time today. Nice to meet you.
To meet you.
Welcome, Andy. Thanks for coming in and being part of the podcast.
My pleasure.
We really just wanted to share some. Andy's a songwriter, and his wife is a songwriter and a singer. And you know, something that's interesting to me personally, and it would be to hear a little bit about how you think and perceive Jill's journey on this whole thing to be. As we've talked about some of the letters we've read, some of the guests we've had on have said, you know, well, you know. My husband, he is a different guy, but I still feel like I've been hit by a train. And they're always looking for help for that. In fact, one of the things that Nate gets asked most often is, you know, is how is Allie handling this? My question to you would just be, how is Jill, how has she handled this whole thing? What's the arc look like?
Man, every story feels like it's, you know, its own little nightmare, but when you hear a bunch of different stories, the feelings are similar across the board, I think. Mm-hmm. Felt in different ways, but for the wives, hers was not much different, you know. It was kind of feelings of betrayal and trust issues, and rightfully so. And I think for her, kind of a turning point, we kind of jumped into, you know, immersing ourselves in counseling from the very beginning. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of like we weren't going to waste any time. Mm-hmm. I remember somebody saying, you know, when you're at moments, rock bottom moments, your marriage will either be tons better or dissolve.
Mm-hmm.
And we made a conscious decision to say, we don't want it to dissolve. Mm-hmm. We want it to be tons better. So whatever it takes to get there, that's what we want to do. And so some great counseling. But I think for her, a big one of the things that helped her move on and start to, you know, let the guard back down to rebuild the relationship was just to see that I was actually serious about doing something, whether that was counseling, whether that was meeting with guys, whatever it was. I mean, all of the above.
Mm-hmm.
And the hard thing is, that's not something that she can see in a week or a month or even a year. You know, mm-hmm. it's not like I could go to something. We've all seen guys be really sincere about something, but not really willing to fully commit.
Yeah.
So I could be going to meetings every single day for a year, and it might not still make that much of a difference. So I think for her, seeing over the long run that listen, I'm serious about this, and I know I can't prove that I'm serious about this in any short-term answer.
Yeah.
So I'm going to prove it by running the long race, you know. And I'm still running the long race. And I think the fact that I'm still running a long race, you know, allows her to be that trust. And I think she was able, when she knows that I have guys that I talk to on a regular basis,
mm-hmm.
and that I'm not living in an isolation.
Mm-hmm.
She's able to let go of the feeling that she might have to police that, or, mm-hmm. you know, it allows us to be a married couple and to have fun and to laugh and to, you know, talk about other stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, for her, like I said, it's not a quick fix.
Yeah.
But you, but we, even when we were, you know, she wasn't very happy with me, we were able to sit down and say, okay, this is going to be really hard, but what do we want this to look like 10 years down the road?
Mm-hmm.
And if we want to look that way, everyone around us is telling us that you're going to have to really work hard and go through a lot of crap to get there.
Mm-hmm.
So are we willing to do that? Yes, we're willing to do that. Of course, we don't know what exactly all that crap is. And there might be times where we feel like, oh, it's not worth it.
Mm-hmm.
But we committed and said, this is what we're going to do. And I think without that kind of commitment, even with that commitment, both people saying 100%, let's go at it, even if I don't like you right now.
Mm-hmm.
Without that, I don't know how people do it.
Yeah.
And without believing that there's a God that is orchestrating this for the good of our marriage and for the betterment of ourselves and the people around us, man, I don't know how it happens.
Right. Once again, that idea of the sacred marriage, idea, you know, that what if marriage is about being holy as opposed to being happy?
Right.
You know? And that they actually, God puts that person in your life to actually draw the thing out of you so that it comes out in the open, pulls the silver dollar out of the pocket of your heart and shows the world, you know. What about, like Hallie was talking about how the real turning point for them, too, came when she realized that she wasn't quite as shiny as she thought, you know, and I know for a lot of women that we've talked to, that sort of seems to be a big thing, like they finally equate that they actually have things in their life that need to be worked out as well.
Well, I was very lucky. I mean, Jill, you know, from the beginning, that wasn't a big revelation to her.
Mm-hmm.
Awesome. It wasn't even that she knew what it was, but I think she was willing to accept, as counselors were saying, now you're both going to work on stuff. Mm-hmm. She was never like, you know, and some people, it's just all blaming, and she was, I really lucked out, you know, I way over married. So she was just willing to accept responsibility for, not even accept responsibility, but willing to examine her own life.
Mm-hmm.
She's real self-aware.
And I've heard stories that, I mean, most people, it's a lot more difficult than that.
Yeah.
So I'm grateful for that every day.
That, my friend, is a gift from God.
No kidding.
Yeah.
No kidding.
Jill has a song. It's called Any Other Way. And it's just very powerful.
This song tore me up the first time I heard it. I played it as an offertory at Christ Community Church one day. And I thought it stated so beautifully that moment when a marriage, almost any marriage, almost every marriage that's lasted any length of time has hit this point where, you know, you've hit a wall, suddenly you realize that, you really realize that both of you are broken, and you make a decision. Then it comes to a point, what are you going to do?
Yeah.
This story stated it so well, and in such a the song did, in such a hopeful way, I couldn't get it out of my head.
And it just so, it really encapsulates the process, you know, and that's hard to do in 4 minutes. and I just appreciate so much you guys, for real, living out loud in front of people, because it's not an easy thing to do, and it's not easy to be truthful in your philosophy, your worldview of life, and then, you know, that's usually reflected in your art. It's even harder, I think, to be really honest in your art, you know, and I appreciate it.
Thank you.
You know? Let me read this lyric for him, and then I think we ought to just play him the song.
Okay.
You know? Do you remember that Monday when the world fell out beneath our feet, both surprised that we had been so close to losing everything? Putting one foot in front of the other felt like such a long, hard step to take. We thought about moving and starting again, but it was something we could never outrun, so we just stayed. I wouldn't have it any other way. I wouldn't have it any other way. Gaining back the trust we lost was harder than just losing it. But if we wanted to change at all, the pain was a prerequisite. So little by little, a piece at a time. We were putting back together what was left of a broken life. It wasn't quick. It wasn't easy. But that kind of change isn't one that happens overnight. I wouldn't have it any other way. I wouldn't have it any other way. When we first met, love was a feeling. But making it last, that's a decision. A good decision. And when we watch the kids run through the yard, sometimes I just can't help but think that every bit of what it cost was worth it for this family. Because I wouldn't have it any other way. I wouldn't have it any other way. I wouldn't have it any other way.
I wouldn't have it any other way.
We're back at the Pirate Monk Podcast, SamsonSociety.org. Andy, powerful. Those, like I was just saying off mic, you know, the art of parable where a line means something when you read it one way and you read it again and it means another thing and it means another thing. I couldn't have it in any other way. I couldn't have attained it any other way. I wouldn't have attained it. I wouldn't have it any other way. You know, it just like just keeps like, you know, God wants it to be a certain way and we need it to be a certain way. And I appreciate the process as well. That kind of thing. That stuff kills me when and I think that when you see the art of parable, it's that thing when Jesus tells a story. And Madeline Leigh Ingle, that author, she pointed that out really well in her book Walking on Water, where it means, it says the same exact thing and it means two different things to you, and they're equally true. You know, so I commend you. It's very well done. And Nate, I think this is.
Yeah, I'd love to talk with you a bit, Andy, about. I see you brought your guitar, by the way, and yes. Thank you for doing that.
Sure.
Because I want you to play The Secret for us a little later.
Awesome.
It's a big part of the 48 Hours of Frankness retreat that Samson guys do around the country, and the guys are going to get to hear you play it live here. That's awesome. But I'd love to talk with you about the process of rebuilding trust. I know that when I'm out talking, typically the first question I get from an audience has to do with my wife, or the restoration, the rebuilding of our marriage. What's your experience in that as a guy kind of facing his demons and at the same time believing God for the restoration of a marriage?
Well, I mean, my wife and I kind of hit rock bottom 6 years ago, so it's been, you know, I can't say that we're relatively young, only been married 11 years, which, you know, is long in some scheme of things, but others, you know, there's plenty of room for more pain in the future. I think what we've learned has a lot to do with one of the things you started off saying in the last podcast about God taking his time with creation, you know, and it's not, you know, our salvation experience isn't really, being born again isn't necessarily just an automatic thing. It's something that it's happening over and over again. We're being saved over and over again. The marriage is the same way. I think it would be impossible for there to be a quick fix where you regain trust and, you can look and act lovingly to each other automatically.
Mm-hmm.
So kind of what I try to encourage people who are going through a hard time, I just say, just believe that it's there, out there in the future.
Mm.
And don't worry about trying to make it happen right now.
Mm.
But that it's the process is part of what makes it heal.
Mm.
You know, a lot of people are just looking for, I've had guys say to me, you know, I've apologized, I'm doing everything I can. I'm like getting up, taking care of the kids in the morning. I'm doing everything I possibly can. When is she going to love me again?
Yeah.
And the answer is, well, it might be a really long time.
Yeah.
But being on this end of it, man, it's worth waiting.
Yes.
And it's still, after 6 years, it's still getting better, and it's still changing, and it's still healing. There are ways in which it's healing that we didn't even know needed healing. So, I mean, what I try to encourage people is just to stick around for that ride, because it's really worth it.
Hey, just some background, like, where are you from?
I'm from Texas, and I met... I moved to Nashville to go to Belmont University.
Mm.
That's where I met Jill.
Uh-huh.
I
didn't know that she did music. She didn't know that I did music. We kind of met in class, and then we were in a Bible study together and started dating, and then kind of the music you know, our different music careers kind of started out of that, and we've kind of, you know, performed together professionally now for 10 or 11 years, but all through college we did that too.
So you tour together?
Yes.
Artist and part of her band?
A separate artist, yeah. I mean, when she has her own shows, I'm her guitar player and backup singer, and I think in 11 years I've missed two of her shows. And then I do my own solo stuff too. And when I do that, she stays home with the kids. And
Probably I've seen two of my wife's shows in 11 years. So I'm just kidding. No. And I read in your bio that you're a big disc golf player, or George Costanza says, froth
yeah.
Frisbee golf. Yeah.
George Costanza did not use the correct terminology. But yes, I started playing when I was in college,
you're pretty good, right?
You're
pretty good. Come on now.
I'm decent. There are a lot of people who are a lot better than I am, but you know, I could take out any amateurs, and no problem.
Right. So if you go out and play with your friends, you're going to win, right?
Most of my friends, there are a couple who will beat me. But yeah, it's fun. It's actually, I've got three little kids, so I don't have much time to play in Nashville like I used to. But when I'm, especially when I'm traveling, especially by myself,
right?
I always bring my disc golf disc with me, and actually, it's part of a big master plan of finding ways to fill up the idle time, because idle time is always what got me in trouble before. Mm-hmm. So if I'm, you know, if I play somewhere one night and I have a full day, I'll schedule to go play disc golf, and I'll just make new friends on the course. And then if I have a free night, I've become an avid bowler, so I have no problems going on a Friday night to a bowling alley and bowling by myself for, you know, 2 hours.
Or writing haikus.
Yeah, or writing haikus. It's like,
I read a bunch of this. Andy writes haikus for, like, a lot of the cities that he tours in. There's one
a haiku review of every show, don't you?
Yes, okay. I try to, yeah.
For those of our guests who don't, I mean our listeners who don't know, a haiku is like a 3-line poem after the Japanese style. Usually it has 17 syllables or something like that.
Yeah, 5-7-5.
5-7-5.
I don't adhere to it strictly all the time.
All the masters don't adhere to it strictly, right, just so you know. So, I like this one. I want to hear the story behind it, if you don't mind. In Lenora City, Tennessee, the haiku is, after my first song, "You have any Jesus songs?" yelled my first heckler. I must hear the story behind that one.
That was an interesting show. I started off, it was for an arts team of this church, so they're 100 people there, so it was a small room, and I told them I wanted it to be kind of conversational, and, you know, if they had questions or anything, and the first song I played is a song called "If I Were the Devil," which I wrote after
I love that
reading Screwtape Letters, so it's kind of in the vein of Screwtape Letters. It's kind of how the devil's a little bit more sneaky than we think he is, you know?
Right.
And afterwards, I heard somebody stand up and say a question, and I was like, "What?" And he said, "Do you have any songs about Jesus?" And I was like, I thought he was joking. Uh-huh. So I was like, no, I don't. And he says, "Well, I don't think we should be wasting any time singing about anything other than Jesus."
Oh.
And I said, "Oh, you're being serious.
Wow.
I actually think the last song was about Jesus. And I do have songs about Jesus." And he just kept kind of arguing with me. In my mind, I was thinking...
Oh, my goodness.
In my mind, I'm just thinking, okay, just stay calm, be nice to this guy. And what I was trying to say to him was like, okay, maybe you feel that way, but why don't you just sit down and listen to 2 or 3 songs to see if God speaks to you through them.
Yeah.
And because not all the songs... I mean, my stuff, there are some songs that are explicitly about Jesus, maybe, but most of them aren't. They're about life. In the context of being a Christian.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was asking this guy, you know, trying to be composed, saying, just sit down and listen. And he wasn't game for it. And they actually escorted him out. But The sad thing is they recorded that show, and so I got to listen back to it, and I was thinking, I want to hear what a great job I did, you know, diffusing this. And it's basically what I said. I basically did say sit down and listen to a couple songs, but it took me 5 minutes to say it because I was so out of breath.
Mm.
I was just like, what? Don't you just sit down? I was so nervous. I was trying to act like I wasn't nervous, and I... You know, but I was just happy to have my first heckler. It was kind of fun.
I can't believe it. No, I'm sorry, though. That was so good. I have to ask one more. January 18th of this year, you're in Orlando, Florida, and the haiku is, some neighbors are nice, some drive you to the airport, some sacrifice goats. I'm like...
I mean, it's self-explanatory, right?
Well, it's evocative.
That was actually a house show for... some guys out in Orlando who were talking about starting up a Samson group down there.
Yeah.
And I went to kind of tell my story and with song and kind of talk about what Samson Society has meant to me. And the guy whose house it was, his next door neighbor, some...
Uh-huh.
I don't remember what the name of the religion is.
Oh, Santeria?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Santeria.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's where you, like, sacrifice... You pray to God and everybody, but then you sacrifice just in case you piss Satan off.
Yeah, there's something funky going on there. It was pretty awesome.
Oh my goodness! Oh my goodness!
And that was the same. I think around that same trip, maybe it was that trip. Well, I was in Orlando and went to go play disc golf. There's another haiku about that, but usually I'll show up on a disc golf course and just look for other guys. And ask them if I can join, join the game because they know the course and you know I've never played there before. And in Orlando, I found there are these three guys who were ahead of me, and I walked up and I said, "Hey, do you mind if I
if I'd be your fourth?
If I join you?" And they asked me a pretty standard question to be asked on a disc golf course if you ask that question, and it is, "Are you a cop?" And that's when I knew I was going to have some interesting conversations. As soon as I let them know I was not a cop, they let me join them and pulled out some herbs pretty soon after that.
Oh, so that disc golfing and herbage go together.
You know, they seem to in a lot of markets. Whenever I played in Nashville, I played some tournaments, and they always say there's no drugs, no alcohol. And then you get, like, four holes in, and people start hitting trees. And but it always gave me an edge, because I was like, you go ahead and smoke that stuff, and I will beat you. Because I won't be so laid back.
Well, and then, of course, the one in Nashville that's more evocative of what we're talking about here today is a QA time. A Q&A time is much more unnerving when you know everyone.
Yeah.
There you are.
That's the truth.
And that is the truth.
Yeah. Well, Andy, you said you'd play The Secret for us.
Yeah.
Would you mind breaking out the guitar? And it's another one. If you haven't, by the way, dear listeners, if you haven't heard an Andy Gullhorn song, this is kind of like the quintessential Andy song, I think.
Yeah. It's really good. And, you know, you can go to andygullhorn.com or joephillips.com, and you can find all these records.
Or you can download them off iTunes.
Right off of iTunes. And,
or you can invite Andy to come to your church, men's group, he will play them live.
That's right.
Yeah.
When I first started trying to piece my life back together and started finding myself in various groups of guys who were telling their stories, which was a big part of getting better, you know, there were guys that were dealing with things that had never even entered my mind, much less something that I was dealing with. Some things, I heard stories of things that were just, I thought were awful. But there's one common thread through every story, and that common thread was just that that something had happened, maybe not just one event, but for some reason we were all convinced that there's something about ourselves that we couldn't tell anyone else. And so I was able to see kind of what happens when you have that and you foster it, you keep it hidden, and there's a million different ways that it could grow and all just trying to come out in the open. And that's basically what this song is about. Back when Charlie was a boy, somebody handed a secret down. With a long list of unwritten rules, so he died before he let it out. He carried it like a silver dollar in the pocket of his heart. He cried out for some room to breathe, but his pride just kept it in the dark. And the darkness was like rainfall to a flower that needed it to grow. Kept digging deeper till they wrapped their wretched arms around his soul. Oh, gotta let that secret go. Well, that boy soon became a man. Thought he was too strong to lose. Surrounded by a wife and friends who knew everything about him except the truth. 'Cause the truth was like a double-edged sword in someone else's hands. He knew his friends would listen, but he never thought they could understand. Oh, not the way the secret can. In the middle of the sidewalk is a single blade of grass. It kept pushing up from under till it finally made a crack. When that crack became a canyon wide, it was past the point of covering. With no familiar place to hide, Charlie set the secret free. His freedom was a hammer to a darkroom wall that let the light shine through. 'Cause he knew carrying secrets to the grave is impossible to do. Secrets carry you.
Awesome. Andy, that was so powerful. I was saying before, if anybody had not disclosed before they heard their song, surely they will after they hear that song. And, just so many lines in that song. What's your favorite, Nate?
Well, the
killer.
The killer line is the end line.
Yeah, which is?
Carrying secrets is impossible to do. Right. The secrets carry you.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah. And I thought the world would end when people found out, when they saw the real me, when they knew how broken I really am. And I thought my life would be over. And that's where it started. Of course, I wasn't ready to disclose the secrets until it looked like everything else was lost. It really took... Incidentally, at the website pornaddicthubby.com, there's a line there, something there, a piece of information I hadn't gathered before, but it makes sense to me. They say, I think, maybe quoting this wrong, for every one guy who discloses voluntarily, there are four or maybe five who get into recovery only under pressure from wife or girlfriend. And I know that's my story. It was a one-shot chance to save my marriage.
Wow.
That saved my life.
It did, didn't it?
Yeah.
And, well, Andy, your whole situation, you, of course, were under a lot of pressure to disclose and to change your behavior, I reckon.
Yeah, kind of luckily, I wasn't even under so much pressure to disclose. It was kind of disclosed for me.
Mm-hmm.
Which I'm just convinced that with my personality, that's the way it had to go down. I wouldn't recommend it to anyone.
Yeah.
You know, I was pretty good at I was pretty good at hiding things, and you know, I would have held on to it forever if I wasn't forced into something.
Yeah.
And you know, I think that's, some guys are able to hear something and be like, you know, I don't want to live this way anymore, and make a choice to do something different, or at least start down a path of something different. And for me, I think I knew that's what I wanted, but I was too chicken to do it myself, so I need a little kick in the butt to get me going.
Yeah.
And it got a big kick in the butt to get me going, and I'm so grateful for it. I mean, I always tell people, you know, everyone has a different story of how they went down that road, and I don't recommend my path, but any path that gets you there
is
worth
path.
Taking. Yeah.
Yeah. That's a point you made in that song I love off your latest album, Andy, where you talk about how you wouldn't have scripted your life the way it's turned out.
Hmm.
But apparently God knows what he's doing.
Hmm. It's hard to believe sometimes. Some of it is, you know, to me, when everything came crashing down, that's really the point when faith actually means something. You have to believe that there's a reason behind it. You have to believe that there's a hope out there to hold on to. Because if there's not, then, you know, it's hard to get up in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so for me, yeah, that song you're talking about, if I was writing my own story, it would be totally different.
Mm-hmm.
It would be about how big my muscles are and, you know, I'd be in the NBA right now. but I'm obviously not writing this story. And but trusting that that all these things, the good and the bad and the hard, the difficult and the easy, like if you can really step back and look at it with perspective. And like I said, I've got 6 years of perspective. When I look back on it, with 50 years of perspective, it's going to look totally different.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what will be the same is that I'll see that God's hand was at work in the whole thing, orchestrating every little piece of it. And that's what I... Sometimes that's easy to remember, and sometimes it's very hard to remember. So I kind of... A lot of the songs that I write, I'm reconvincing myself that that's what's happening. So mm-hmm. I can listen to it and say, okay, remember there was this time when you knew for sure that God was orchestrating something beautiful out of this mess. And just kind of, it's something to hold on to.
Yeah.
Because sometimes I forget that.
Hmm. Well, I think it's a great way to close the podcast is to play the song. It's off the latest Andy Gullhorn CD called The Law of Gravity. And this is a final cut, Why You Brought Me Here. Thanks, Andy, for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I know I'll get an answer that I won't understand. If I ask that your intentions be made clear, I know your plans are greater, and in that greater plan lie the reasons why you brought me here. This story would be different if it were only mine to write. There are secrets I would never volunteer. But secrets lose their power when they have no place to hide. Maybe that is why you brought me here. You know what you're doing, you brought me here. It's a mess of my own making, I fully realize. And the consequences shake my heart with fear. But if I was happy with the way things were, then I'd put up a fight. Guess I'm grateful that you brought me here. Oh, all I see are the ruins, but oh, as the smoke starts to clear, hey, I trust you know what you're doing, you brought. But it's bearable somehow. As the grounds to prove I'm worthy disappear, I always heard you love me, and I think I know it now. It's a reason why you brought me here. Oh, love's the reason why you